If you are listening to Kate's wonderful podcast in America, you may be interested to know that Spectator now has a special US edition and website. My name is Freddie Gray. I edit that edition and website. And I'd like to tell you about a new subscription offer. If you go to spectator.us/free trial, you can get 3 full months digital access absolutely free. It's an amazing offer, and I'd encourage you all to take full advantage of it. That's spectator.us/free trial.
Hello and welcome to Coronomics, the Spectator's 6-part series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. This podcast features our panel based around the world, who select a story each week that gives you an inside look at what's happening outside their windows. Silvia Ciarilli Borelli is reporting from Rome and Milan correspondent for the Financial Times. Jennifer Creary is reporting from Hong Kong and managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Nick Gillespie is reporting from New York City and editor-at-large for Reason Magazine. Welcome all. So the theme for this week from all of us seems to be the lockdown easing debate, but all of your articles and all of your stories from different countries come at this from a different angle. So Silvia, I'll start with you and your article from the Washington Post. Italy has had one of the lengthiest and most restrictive lockdowns in Europe. What's happening now?
Essentially, the article I chose this week was published a few days ago in the Washington Post ahead of the unveiling on Sunday night of the plan to exit the lockdown by the Italian government. But it's still very topical because, unsurprisingly, at least from an Italian perspective, the prime minister's televised speech on Sunday night didn't move the story forward that much. So let me proceed with order. The article explains very clearly the path to lift the lockdown in Italy is particularly risky, including because uncertainties still remain around the actual number of infections across the country. As things stand, the outbreak has been so severe in Italy that the country will be left to grapple the economic and social consequences of COVID-19 for years to come. People are terrified. Thousands of families are mourning their losses, and at the same time, businesses are on their knees. So the prime minister has called for a serious scientific program, which evidently is what he outlined on Sunday night, at least in his view. But at the same time, the article outlines very well the complications any plan of sorts will be faced with. The first thing I'd flag is the fact the government has a myriad of task forces advising on every single policy issue that has been impacted by coronavirus. So you've got economists, business people, scientists, school policy experts, psychiatrists, and it's proven very difficult to encapsulate in a nutshell what the best way forward is. The only thing that everyone is essentially certain of is that the Italian society will be very, very different going forward. And until a vaccine is found, life will not go back to normal. This means rethinking everyday life, including public transportation, scanning workers' body temperature, childcare, holidays, potentially wearing face masks all the time. And at one point, there were suggestions to further limit movement for the elderly. And this attracted lots of criticism and accusations of discrimination towards an age group that has already been hardly hit by this outbreak. Now, this idea seems to have been put to bed, but at the same time, testing and tracing people remains an important element of the discussion, but Italy remains pretty far from a sensible solution on this. Amid concerns over privacy, we discussed last week, but at the same time, due to a lack of capacity to carry out millions of tests. So the bottom line here is that there are very real concerns that once the lockdown measures are lifted, the virus will be back. It will come roaring back, to say it with the words of the Washington Post. But at the same time, the country has already plunged into a recession, which is likely to be the steepest since World War II. So the question is, where do you strike the balance? And just finally, considering what Italians heard from the prime minister on Sunday night, the answer to this crucial question remains broadly unclear. All we know right now is that manufacturing companies and building sites will be allowed to reopen on May 4th, Italians will be finally allowed to exercise outdoors. This has been forbidden since the beginning of March. Shops should reopen by May 18th, but bars, cafes, restaurants, as well as hairdressers and beauty salons, for example, will have to wait until June 1st. And schools might only reopen in September, if not even further down the line. So all of this, of course, raises major questions as to what will happen to all these businesses, especially the smaller ones, and what kind of support and funding they will receive from the government going forward. And the same question about government support applies to families, especially when parents will be asked to return to work, given schools will be closed at least until September. So lots of questions and, quite frankly, very few answers and lack of clarity.
It's remarkable that Italians haven't been allowed to go for walks outside since the beginning of March. And it puts different lockdowns into perspective, because here in the UK, people have been actively encouraged to go outside for an hour a day to get some exercise as long as they're adhering to social distancing measures. But that's just a completely different experience in Italy for families, probably often in very small apartments, to be completely locked up without that outdoor space.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure who's been advising the government on this so far. But what I'm noticing is that because children and individuals are so frustrated and they are so tired of being stuck indoors, especially now that it's warmer and, you know, it's sunny, you've got children who have been forbidden from taking walks or going to the playgrounds for 2 months, that now people are just frustrated and they are just, you know, autonomously deciding that they're going to relax these measures on their own. And if you take a walk around Rome, even the residential areas where in normal times you'd see very few people walking because most people would be driving, now you see people belonging to different age groups just strolling on the street and essentially taking a walk, either with children or elderly people, even without face masks. But because, of course, people are having a hard time coping with these very restrictive measures. And you know, the more these are extended, the harder it will be for the government to control people.
You know, in New York over the weekend, on Saturday, there was a beautiful spring day and people were really coming out more than I've seen since the lockdown began. But people were also, you know, pretty good about, almost everyone I saw was wearing a mask. Most people were steering clear of each other. And even in public places like Washington Square Park, you know, people were pretty good, but it, and then on Sunday it was a kind of cold and rainy day and there was virtually no one out. But I think in the United States, certainly in New York, you're starting to see the fraying of this. And, you know, I'm thinking in particular of something about a month ago, Governor Andrew Cuomo here said, you know, that 1-2% of New Yorkers dying is unacceptable. We won't let that happen. I think now as this stuff goes on and as caseloads both go up or down, oftentimes, you know, not perversely unrelated to actions that people have taken, but in ways that seem hard to correlate with any kind of, you know, real focus, granular clarity, I think, you know, people are going to be challenging why do healthy people need to, and low risk people need to be locked down in the same way as people who are in the highest risk category. So I think that's going to be part of the place where the political discussion goes very quickly.
It's interesting, though, because, Sylvia, you raised the point that people are also terrified. Yes, I think in all four countries that we're speaking from, we are seeing people start to push the boundaries of those lockdown measures here in the UK as well. I think the parks were much more full this past weekend than they have been. The number of people driving on the road increased as well. But as you say, all of these governments have just pushed this messaging so hard about staying home because of the health risk, for them to sort of flip the switch and say, okay, well, now we need to start thinking about going back to work. We need to start thinking about interacting again, albeit while social distancing, a lot of people are going to be quite scared to send their kids back to school or just to jump on public transport and go back to work. You can't really change that attitude overnight once you've cemented it in.
That's for sure. And for example, I was talking to some contacts in France where schools will be allowed to reopen as early as May 11th. And they were saying that in many towns, it will not be the case because local schools have not had the opportunity to actually, you know, make all those renovations that are required to make sure that teachers and students can return to school in safety. And also parents are very concerned, as they are in Denmark and in other parts of Europe where these measures will be lifted. But of course, what is happening now in Italy is that you've got workers essentially questioning, why do we have to go back to work? Why do we have to go back in a factory where perhaps the 1 meter distance that is required for all other activities cannot be maintained, while at the same time Italians are not trusted enough by the government to essentially go out for a walk and take responsibility for it? And many Italian media outlets have been showing this picture of people sunbathing on a riverside in Germany, in Munich, and essentially they've flagged this to contrast the approach of the German and the Italian government. And they've said the German example shows how essentially in that country, citizens are trusted a lot more and they are made to be responsible. And that is why the response and potentially the severity of the outbreak hasn't been as bad as in Italy, where essentially even in places and in regions like the southern region of Calabria, where on Sunday you had only one new infection, people are still not allowed to go out and to resume working or even just, you know, stroll around with their children. So obviously there are major questions here and it's a very, very difficult balance.
Comparing the lockdown measures in different countries is fascinating, as is comparing the personalities which are at the helm of the decision-making process in all of these countries. The story I've picked out this week from the UK is from the Daily Telegraph, though it's covered widely in the press. The Prime Minister Boris Johnson has returned after battling COVID-19 for weeks, first in hospital, then in the ICU, and then recovering outside of London. He did his first live public address to the nation this morning, where he asked the public to contain their impatience about the lockdown. He has not lifted any of the measures yet, but the tone was so dramatically different from what we've had in his absence. We had been told by those standing in his place that it was way too soon to talk about easing lockdown restrictions. We couldn't have that conversation. Now he's back and automatically he's sympathizing with the public about the lockdown. He says he wants to get out of it. They're going to be working towards it. And it just struck me how much personality matters and how much a certain individual can matter in circumstances like this. Before the Prime Minister came back, it seemed nearly impossible that the UK could be looking at coming out of lockdown. And we're actually falling a bit behind the rest of Europe in terms of our future focus on what easing restrictions could look like. And now he's back and you think we have, you know, one of the most libertarian prime ministers in Europe again. So I was just wondering to what extent you guys think in your different countries that one or two key person has made a difference to your lockdown measures.
You know, I'll say that Donald Trump has made himself a kind of lightning rod throughout his presidency. And I think that tendency has just been really kind of exacerbated during the coronavirus pandemic. And he may have taken himself out of daily press conferences at the close of last week, after he made some rambling and basically incoherent, but not necessarily completely wrong remarks about possible treatments using heat and light and whatnot for coronavirus. But he kind of said, I may not be coming back to these press conferences that he had instituted. And a lot of the debate here, and it's extremely frustrating, to be honest, especially if you're not a partisan. You know, the United States, because of the two-party system and a first-past-post system, there's only Republicans and Democrats to talk about. There's not really coalitions. And even within those parties, there's increasingly less kind of heterodoxy. So you have, you know, Donald Trump and then maybe Nancy Pelosi as his counter because she's the Speaker of the House, and a couple of high profile governors, Andrew Cuomo probably being the most publicly visible. But it becomes really tedious because the discussion about the disease and about public policy really comes down to how do you feel about Donald Trump? And so when he says something good, people who are loath to hate him, and that's at least half of the country, don't want to agree with him when they agree with him. And half of the people who disagree with him kind of suck it up when he says something stupid because they don't want to disagree with him. And it really perverts the whole process. It would be much better at least in a United States context, I think, if we were talking more about policy and if we were talking about it more, you know, the way that it appears COVID-19 is showing up in different parts of the country, because it's a very different experience in Texas and in Wyoming and in Alaska and New York. But we're talking about it as if it all matters because of what Donald Trump is saying, you know, every afternoon in D.C.
Yeah, so I'll just jump in with what's happening in Hong Kong, particularly Chief Executive Carrie Lam, that's Hong Kong's leader, who was already registering extremely low popularity ratings since last year when we had citywide protests. And so the introduction of any kind of government measure aimed at essentially preventing the spread of the coronavirus has been instantly politicized, as we talked about last week. But because Carrie Lam is such a vilified figure, and there's a very low bar of tolerance when it comes to the public tolerating the government and any government measures, instantly, of course, that was met with opposition from members of the pro-democracy camp and particularly members of the public. Now, it's really interesting to note, actually, that one of the restrictions, that is a ban of public gatherings of no more than 4 people, we saw over the weekend, actually, hundreds of people continue to gather in a protest. So, for example, on Sunday, hundreds of people gathered in a shopping mall to call for the resumption of last year's demonstrations. And actually, when the police came in and they said that the crowd was in violation of social distancing measures, actually, prior to the coronavirus, any large number of people gathering in public spaces would be in violation of basically participating in what is known as an unauthorized assembly. But I think because of the coronavirus and the current public anger against, particularly leveled against Chief Executive Carrie Lam, the government and the police, it's certainly made people even angrier and more expressive when it comes to their opposition to the coronavirus social distancing measures.
That's just fascinating, because while in the UK, some of Boris Johnson's political opponents have said that he's getting too easy of a ride because he became unwell and we must hold the government to account, I would say, broadly speaking, even those who disagree with him politically have been waiting with bated breath for him to come back, knowing that he was the only key that could unlock these restrictions on the lockdown and roll back some of those measures. And so broadly, it's not necessarily a sense of unity, that's going a bit too far, but his personality and him as a person matters so, so much to the UK's response that isn't riling up anger or frustration in the same way that obviously it is in other parts of the world.
Kate, can I ask you, obviously the great leaders of the past 70 or so years in Britain are Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher, and they both were, you know, like carry-on types of people. Is Johnson consciously channeling that, or is that just really kind of part of the way that British leaders talk? And then the question I guess I have is, you know, Winston Churchill was telling Brits to, you know, just put up with worse and worse conditions for, you know, an extended period of time. Is Boris Johnson's message that we need to, like, keep a stiff upper lip and go out and possibly die of COVID-19? Or is it, you know, I mean, is that his message, which seems a little bit at odds with some of the other, you know, kind of messages that leaders are trying to push?
Well, to answer your first question, Winston Churchill is thought to be Boris Johnson's political hero. He wrote a book about Churchill called The Churchill Factor, How One Man Made History. And given that the coronavirus is now being referred to on countless occasions as a war, it is wartime against a different kind of enemy, I think it would be very fair to infer that Boris Johnson is trying to channel the Churchill factor, whatever that may be to him, and to use it in his own crisis during his own premiership, as Winston Churchill did many decades ago. And whether or not he's successful in that, I suppose, will be for the history books to decide. But to your second question, no. The attitude coming from the Prime Minister today was not to take the stiff upper lip, to go outside and risk it. It was very much the opposite, that people needed to stay indoors and to continue to abide by the lockdown measures. But I suppose the difference between today and what we've had in previous weeks in the Prime Minister's absence was just a real sense that he wasn't happy about it. I mean, he was trying to sympathize with business, with workers, and his message was stay home so that we can quite swiftly move move into the next phase where we try to ease some of these lockdown restrictions. So no, the message was not go out there and risk it, be brave. It was the brave thing to do is to stay inside, even though I know that's very difficult for many people. So we can move on to the next phase. Nick, I'll throw back to you because you've picked out an article from the Wall Street Journal, which is also about the lockdown, but more specifically about the science around the lockdown, or perhaps the lack of science. So talk us through this article.
Yeah, so this was a profile of John Ioannidis. I'm mispronouncing his name, but he's a well-known researcher at Stanford Medical School. About a month ago or so, he talked early on as this discussion was starting about the epidemiology and particularly the infection fatality rate and the case fatality rate of COVID-19. And he challenged the idea that was coming out of places like Imperial College in the UK, as well as the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who were prognosticating that absent no adaptive behavior, much less, you know, actual changes in legal strictures on movement, that there could be 1.7 million or 2 million people dying in the United States from COVID-19. And he said that that was really not supported by what evidence was out there, particularly the one cruise ship that is kind of a hotbed or a hothouse example of COVID-19. He has consistently been saying, we don't know enough. We haven't done enough testing and we don't know enough. But that early indicators are that instead of having something like a case fatality rate or an infection fatality rate, I guess is a better measure of, you know, 2% or 3%, it's more likely to be in the range of 0.1% to 0.2%. And the Wall Street Journal article kind of walks through where he's coming from with that. And it includes a lot of information, you know, that I think has largely been lost in many of the public discussions, which is that this is a disease that, you know, is killing people in very different demographic segments. And he reiterates in this that a study that he and his wife, who is also a medical researcher, did showed that people under 65 only accounted for 0.7% of the deaths in Italy and about 1.8% of the deaths so far in New York City. And that when you start to look at the information that way, it becomes, you know, I mean, he doesn't necessarily say this, but the implication is extremely strong that the reaction that we are doing in most of, you know, the known world and certainly the OECD countries is a blunderbuss approach where we should be much more surgical, both about saving people by quarantining people at high risk, but also about letting people who are at much lower risk to go out and go about their business. Not because, and you know, I think Kate, your points are really taken, that, you know, just because lockdowns end, it doesn't mean people are going to go, you know, surging out to movie theaters and restaurants and things like that, but to keep some semblance of the economy, the regular, the normal economy functioning. So, you know, I think Ioannidis is, you know, we're going to be litigating the epidemiology of this for years to come. But he is probably the most prominent person who is questioning the idea that the way that this disease is affecting people means that everybody should be locked down equally. And I think it's an important, a very important point and voice in this conversation, which in the U.S. anyway, is mostly being overshouted by people who are like, we need to do everything to save every life and everybody needs to be treated exactly the same way.
I think that's very interesting because from an Italian perspective, considering the country has quite an old population on average, you really couldn't have afforded any other response from the one we've seen, at least during the first phase of the outbreak. I mean, you have to consider many Italians live with their older relatives or rely on grandparents for childcare. Many younger people after the 2011-2012 financial crisis have been unemployed and count on their older family members' pensions for financial support. So older people are such an important part of this society that you simply couldn't afford a sort of Darwinian response to this crisis. Also, there was a big outcry here in Italy when Boris Johnson mentioned herd immunity. It was interpreted as a way of essentially saying older people could be left to die. And even if Italian hospitals have struggled with undercapacity, And just like in the UK and elsewhere, and we know there have been cases where older patients have had to give up their ventilators or hospital beds to save younger people's lives socially and culturally. It's simply hard to fathom, and it's an unacceptable message. And I think that's one of the reasons for which right now there's a lot of concern and anxiety on the effects that easing the restrictions will have on older members of the population as their younger family members return to work, start going out, and further down the line, the minute schools resume, and there is more social interaction, and these people might be exposed to greater risks than they currently are.
Do you have a sense? I mean, I appreciate all of those kind of confounding variables and situations. And Italy has a particularly older population and more multi-generational households than a lot of other developed economies. But, you know, at a certain point, it's almost, and I say this, I'm 56, you know, I'm edging up into the higher risk categories and things like that. It just seems like the events of the past 20 years of the entire 21st century have been really punishing towards the young. You know, they grow up in a lockdown based on 9/11, at least in the U.S. They really bore the brunt of the financial crisis in terms of immediate and long, you know, and kind of lingering effects of unemployment, underemployment, low economic growth, you know, and then this. And it's like, I'm curious, and I guess this isn't a normative question, but, you know, like, is there a moment where, you know, the younger half of the population around the globe is just like, screw it. You know, like this, you know, why are we can't be expected to wait for, you know, for the older generation to get back on their feet or something like that. It just, I'm curious as to the United States, certainly, and obviously places like France and Germany in 68 and England, as a matter of fact, in the 60s, has a history of youth revolt. And I'm just curious if, you know, if that has gone missing or if it's going to come up sooner rather than later.
I think in Italy, it's not necessarily going to be confined to the youth population, but something is going to come up sooner or later because the economy is going to plunge into a very steep recession. And if younger people were already battling with unemployment, the situation is only going to be worse going forward. And there are forecasts of about 40% of small businesses shutting down as a consequence of this crisis. And up until this moment, Italian politics and institutions and the various governments that have led Italy across the past decade weren't able to really respond to these needs of the younger part of the population, but even the older people, the ones who were say 35 when they lost their job 10 years ago and are still without one. And the situation, I think, is going to be very complicated, especially going forward, because if Italian public debt will balloon to 180% of GDP this year, and potentially the EU fiscal rules that have been put on hold this year in order to respond to this crisis will be put back in place next year, it means that Italy is going to have to go through a series of very, very painful reforms to get back on a fiscal track. And this normally is something that impacts even in the medium and long term on younger people. So I think there are very complicated times ahead. It really depends on how Italians will respond. After the last crisis, they responded by increasingly supporting populist parties. Now, one of these populist parties is in government and it doesn't seem like it is giving adequate responses. So I wonder if this will lead to changes in politics as well.
Jennifer, young people were such an important part of the protests in Hong Kong last year, and arguably they've been having a very difficult time of it and a very prominent time of it over the past 12 months. How are they responding in Hong Kong?
Yeah, so Hong Kong people, as you say, have been, especially Hong Kong youngsters, have been at the forefront of the protests. And actually last year we really saw the generational divide between young people and old people exacerbated because of the political crisis. Now, as for the coronavirus, particularly when it comes to anger leveled against the government, of course, that is intrinsically connected to existing political grievances. I think in terms of having a lockdown, it is simply not possible to just stop or work. And in Hong Kong, we haven't had a lockdown as we've seen in other countries. And certainly this is due to the fact that Hong Kong is an incredibly expensive city with sky high rent. And the fact that many people still live with their parents well into their 20s and sometimes even 30s, just simply because it is incredibly unaffordable in Hong Kong. So when it comes to anger leveled against the government, all of that is already existing because of the protests last year. And so many of the people you see out in the streets, particularly the people that we saw on Sunday when it came to the protests in the shopping mall, many of them were young, but also kind of middle-aged. We don't typically see older people out there on the streets, but perhaps when the coronavirus dies down, we may see a more kind of a different demographic of protesters.
Nick, it's interesting you talk about this age divide because just early this week, King's College London here in the UK published a study showing what they group as the accepting, the suffering, and the resisting when it comes to the coronavirus lockdown. And it kind of fits into what you're saying. The accepting category, the key demographics are 59% male with a mean age of 50. The suffering, and that's meant to be those who are going along with the lockdown measures but are feeling very anxious and struggling with it. The key demographics are 64% women with the mean age of 44. The resisting are only 9% of their findings, but the key demographic is actually quite strongly male with a mean age of 29. And I do think that reflects what you're saying, that it weighing up the cost of the lockdown is different for different generations. And people who are around the age of 29 or 30 have already been through a lot. Now, here in the UK, there is still broadly public support for this lockdown to keep themselves safe and others safe, whether they love them or don't know them. But as job loss continues to go through the roof, as I suspect it will around the world, that's going to get harder and harder to square, really, especially with the young.
Yeah, there's some reports in the U.S., depending on how you calculate, you know, actual unemployment, that we might be close to 20%, which is a figure last seen in the 30s during the Great Depression here. You know, again, in the United States, and I suspect this may be more typical of the U.S., but, you know, the country is so vast and the impacts are so different, even within the same state. I mean, if you looked at New York State, you know, in New York City as two separate entities, they're having a radically different experience with this. And, you know, there's a longstanding tradition for a kind of more decentralized approaches to stuff here. So, you know, we'll see.
Jennifer, last but certainly not least, you're looking at the lockdown in Hong Kong from a public health perspective, and you flagged a report from RT Hong Kong, which is the public broadcasting service there, talking about the potential for non-emergency or optional surgeries to start taking place again in Hong Kong. So talk us through that.
Yeah, so the story I chose this week was about health authorities considering resumption of non-emergency services in public hospitals, as you say. Many of these services were, of course, put on hold when the outbreak first started. This is, for example, diagnostic imaging and, you know, stuff like that. And so, as with other countries, this was primarily to prevent the public healthcare system from being overwhelmed, but also to prevent people who have pre-existing health conditions from entering a public hospital and therefore putting themselves at greater risk of contracting the virus. But kind of more importantly, it was because of a lack of isolation rooms and beds available, and as well as PPE equipment, so personal protective equipment. Now, in the report, health authorities have said that current supplies of PPE can last up to 3 months, although N95 masks, those are the tight-fitting surgical masks, are still in short supply. Nonetheless, medical workers do have a sufficient supply. But kind of more broadly speaking, I think this story can be considered in the context of Hong Kong attempting to resume everyday life as it sees a dip in the number of coronavirus cases, as we heard in other stories today. But, you know, Hong Kong has registered single-digit daily new coronavirus cases for a while now. In fact, it registered zero new daily infection cases four times in 1 week. But regardless, the government still decided to extend restrictions, social distancing measures last Tuesday. Now, the current set of social distancing measures, including the closure of facilities like bars and gyms, that's set to expire on May the 7th. But just as we were just talking about, people are going out into the street, going out into commercial districts, and we're really seeing people kind of relaxing a little bit. You know, on Monday, we saw secondary school students begin their university entrance exams, the DSE exams we spoke about last week, although the majority of, you know, schools remain closed. But I think kind of the most important aspect to note in this is that actually few health experts are calling on the relaxation of more stringent measures. So, for example, travel restrictions. And actually, those who are loudest in those calls have been those within Hong Kong's political scene. So, for example, today, several lawmakers, including the one representing the tourism industry in the legislature, aired the suggestion of relaxing the Hong Kong government's 14-day mandatory quarantine for all new arrivals into the city. Now, this was implemented a few months ago when the outbreak first started. But particularly for the lawmakers, they've argued that those restrictions should be relaxed for business people who are required to kind of travel to and from mainland China, but also cross-border families, of which there are quite a few in Hong Kong. Now, as for the current set of restrictions that are meant to expire on May the 7th, there is a very real possibility that the government will extend these measures, particularly given that protesters have even called on people to join a protest on May the 10th, a few days after those restrictions are meant to expire. But of course, the organisers of that protest said that they will delay it if those social distancing measures are extended. But I think more broadly speaking, we're seeing the dawn of the resumption of everyday life in Hong Kong. But I guess the question is, how fast will these restrictions be relaxed? And as we've seen over the past few months, particularly with the government, they tend to take a very conservative approach, at least one that balances the economic impact of the restrictions with public health. So, you know, we're not sure how fast these restrictions will be dropped, but certainly we're seeing a little bit of momentum and a little bit of pressure placed on the government internally and externally.
And it's such a difficult trade-off, isn't it? Because, you know, people try to paint this as if it's the economy versus lives, but your story highlights that it's really lives versus lives. And I noted that the story from RT Hong Kong flagged up that they're worried that there'll be such a flood to specialist doctors and a flood into hospitals that it will risk increasing the infection rate. But if people are flooding in, that's because they're very concerned that their serious health issues haven't been attended to for months now. And, you know, they're doing it with purpose and with reason. They're also worried that they're sick.
Yeah, certainly. And I know that healthcare professionals within the healthcare system are concerned that people with pre-existing health conditions are not coming into hospitals because they're concerned about contracting the virus, as we've seen in other countries. But of course, at least one doctor that I spoke to over the week said she works in respiratory medicine and she is concerned about a delay in non-urgent endoscopies, so for basically detecting lung cancer. So the concern is that by delaying these treatments, you're essentially putting people at greater risk. So there is pressure within the healthcare system to resume these non-urgent services, particularly now that the number of coronavirus cases in Hong Kong has dropped and the healthcare system has largely bounced back. But of course, you know, if there is a second wave, then that could potentially cripple the healthcare system, and we wouldn't want to see that.
I think something similar is kind of brewing in the United States as well, particularly about elective surgery, which is a, you know, a kind of broad and in many ways misleading term. But we have seen, or you see reports of hospitals that have not been overwhelmed with coronavirus patients, but because they have been geared up only to deal with that, they've actually been sending home other healthcare workers because of slack demand, and yet people are not either allowed to or are not coming for other types of diagnostic tests and for surgeries that might have been long planned but aren't, you know, exactly emergencies. It's a real concern when we start to talk about the long term or the overall implications of this stuff, because the, you know, if we only focus on coronavirus cases. We're missing a lot of other things that are directly or indirectly related to, you know, the lockdown and things like that. And again, I mean, I'm not looking forward to it, but you know, we're going to be talking about the public policy implications of this for so long, and it's going to be virtually impossible to tease out what happened because of what. And I worry, and this is partly based on, you know, the way that the U.S. anyway, both at the government level, but in a broader social way, just, you know, failed to learn much from the response to the financial crisis, from the 9/11 response to past pandemics. So, you know, I'm optimistic we'll get through this. I'm pessimistic that we'll learn something that will, you know, well inform the next problem that we have.
These are such tough questions because we simply don't know in any of our countries what the next phase holds, if we will see a spike in the virus as certain decisions are made, whether that's allowing people to go back into hospital for elective surgery or allowing people to go into non-essential stores in Italy. We just don't have the evidence yet. It's going to be a lot of trial and error and very difficult to manage. So I suppose, you know, the takeaway here that we can all relate to is that those answers just aren't there yet. We may not have them for some time, but hopefully, maybe next week we'll have a few more that we can discuss. Nick, Sylvia, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me this week. And listeners, come back next week for the next episode of Coronomics.